Sunday Night Saffron, a babble about religion, politics, and all things ethnic, with John Saffron and Father Bob Maguire.
Good evening, dear listeners. Good evening, Father Bob Maguire.
Good evening to you, sir.
Tonight, dear listener, are you having all this fun with all your little toys, or your little smartphones, or your little shoes?
Little apps.
But you suspect there's something more sinister happening beneath the surface of this world, either controlled by lizards or Freemasons, or maybe just, you know, rich capitalists.
Yeah.
We're going to have Antony Lowenstein, the capitalist stole the H from his name. And he's gone all around the world. He's gone to Afghanistan, to Haiti, to Pakistan, PNG. He's smuggled his way in and out to see what's going on in the secret underbelly of the world, to see just how guilty you should be feeling right now, listening to this show very now out of your clock radio, made on the back of a small Ghanese child.
It's terrible. I mean,
we're also going to be have maybe you're gay and don't want to be gay anymore. We're going to be talking to Luke Williams, another journalist, and he's gone undercover himself to look into the world of gay therapy treatment, which is, of course, what former Greens leader Bobby Brown,
yeah.
That's what he got. He got, like, electrodes in him to try to de-gay himself. Mm. And then we're going to be talking to a woman. Oh, my God. Have you ever, like, tried to write a story and then thought, oh, like, it's a bit boring and, or, you know, like, for uni or something, maybe even high school. And then you're going to be very jealous of this woman. She went out to write a story. She was commissioned to write a story about this guy who was, well, there were all these missing women in her town in America. Mm. We're talking about the mid-70s. Mm. So she was commissioned to go out and write a story about it, which kind of turned into a book. And then whilst writing the book, she finds out she knows the killer. And, like, people just don't believe her at first because it's, like, too convenient that here she is with a deadline to write a book. And then she ends up knowing the killer, but it was all true. Her name's Anne Rule, and she wrote a book called The Stranger Beside Me about serial killer Ted Bundy.
What do you mean? She knew him personally, or she knew who he was?
No, she worked with him. Let's not ruin her story.
Oh, sorry.
Let's not step on her toes. But believe me, it's not a letdown.
You're listening to Sunday Night Saffron on Triple J.
Now, Father Bob.
Yeah?
If you notice, I'm wearing this grey shirt again.
Yeah, grey shirt.
As last week. I think what happened, Father Bob, is I got complimented in this grey shirt by a woman from the ABC. I was walking down the corridor.
And she said, what a beautiful grey shirt.
Yeah, sort of like a combination of me gymming it up to slim down for the book tour that I've been. She goes, oh, that shirt looks really good on you. And she said my shoulders look good in it because, you know, of the, you know, the way. Anyway, I've got this thing that if a girl compliments me on some item, I kind of lock in on it. I'm like, oh. And I used to do it a lot more when I was younger. I was, you know, when you're kind of trying to figure out the world, you probably don't know being celibate.
Yes.
But believe it or not, most of our listeners aren't priests.
Oh, I thought this was a Catholic hour.
No.
Oh, I didn't know.
And so they find themselves, you know, all of these things going on in their head.
Mm, worldly things.
Yeah, like where they're like, oh, how do I kind of talk to her? And, you know, how do I go? Anyway, so when I was younger, a girl complimented me on, she was going, you know, yellow really looks good on you. And I was wearing a yellow top, incidentally. So I was like, oh. And then I went out and I bought two other yellow tops in different styles. And then, like, for the next year and a half, sort of like if I had to go out, if I was, like, going to a party or something.
Yellow.
And
mellow yellow or just...
And it was very hard because yellow is not... Like, if you just say blue's your colour, it's a lot easier. If yellow's hard... I had one yellow bowling shirt, one yellow terry toweling shirt, and I can't remember what the other... I think the other yellow was just, you know, regular kind of yellow.
What?
Shirt.
Straight jacket or something.
No, the yellow thing.
Yeah, yellow is the wake-up-in-the-morning colour.
Looking back at the photos...
Yeah. No, didn't do you any good.
I'm just worried, you know, if I have children and...
Yeah.
Then they have children and they look through the old family photo.
And laugh.
And there's, like, just 2 years where I'm like, pretty much in a yellow terry toweling shirt.
Like a canary in a gilded cage.
I had some real bad and some, like, I've got this theory, dear listener. I don't know if I've told you this before. And men, just tweet me or whatever and tell me if you think this is true. If you're a guy, you can only have one novelty around your face. Right. So what I'm saying is, like, you can either have a goatee, but you should like have a goatee, but that should be the one thing.
Mm.
Like, you shouldn't have a goatee plus spiky hair.
No.
Or you can have the spiky hair, but not the goatee, but not the two. And I was doing some, I wasn't only doubling, I was like tripling. I was doing like
mustache,
wacky goggle glasses. Yes. Kids, before there was Google Glass, there was goggle glasses.
Yeah.
And do you know, I wore a style of glasses on TV for the first time I was on TV that never caught on at all. Like, this guy in a shop tried to convince me that they were going to be the next big thing. And they're sort of, they're like sunglasses, but they're like done like the Air Force glasses. And the guy was telling me, he's going, because he knew I was going to be on TV for the first time, he goes, listen, wear these, you'll be ahead of the curve, because these are going to be huge. Everyone's going to be going around in these goggle glasses. So, yeah, I went around and, yeah, never caught on.
Nobody.
I probably killed it myself, actually,
exactly,
coming to think of it.
Personally killed the line, the fashion line.
Sorry about that goggle glass person. Yeah. And also, sorry about that terry toweling yellow shirt person, if you're wondering why. Yes.
But back to your grey dotted shirt.
Yes, do you like it?
Ironed.
Have you noticed I'm dressing up a bit better?
I just said to Serple on the way in, I said, there's something wrong with this man because he's dressing up better. And he slimmed down.
Mm.
So we both had a long conversation on that.
I was a bit confused because, you know, I bumped into not an ex-girlfriend, but an ex-girlfriend's mother at the fruit shop. And I was in my head, I was like, is this good? Like, because surely she would have looked at me and said, hey, he's dressing up and he's
exactly
slimmed down.
Slimmed down.
But is that, will that get back to her? And is that good? You know what I mean? Like, is she?
I just think it's normal
just,
life.
It's just a thing.
It? But you did a whole TV
She remembers
series
me. I was
on
very,
girlfriend's mother.
I was very puffy when I was going out with this particular girl. And I tell you why. It's because everywhere I went, I think I can. No, I won't say her name.
No, don't say
Do
her
you know
name,
why I won't God say her say. Name? It's because when I was writing the book, one of the editors said to me, he said, John, I know you think it adds all this colourful detail whenever you, like, name a person, but it gets confusing for the listeners because they think, oh, the name's so important. Like, if I just simply say an ex-girlfriend, everyone got it.
That's enough.
As soon as I say the name, it's like getting stressful.
It's a Russian
novel. I've got to remember this or whatever.
Yeah.
Anyway, wherever I went, like, there was just cake. So I'd go to her house and she'd cook some cake. So I'd have to eat the cake to be polite. And then we'd, like, drive over to her auntie's and there'd be, like, her auntie had made some cake too. And then we'd go back to her mother's and her mother's had made cake too. The whole year of the relationship, all I can do is, it's like a montage of me just eating cake.
But was it the same cake?
No, different
cake. I mean, not the same individual cake, but the same kind. Anyway, that's enough of that.
Now, we're going to be talking to Anthony, not Anthony Lowenstein,
not
but Anthony.
We know that,
because
Anthony.
The capitalist stole the H out of his name.
Well, whatever.
Author of Prophets of Doom, How Vulture Capitalism is Swallowing the World.
And About Time Too.
You're listening to Sunday Night Safran with John Safran and Father Bob Maguire on Triple J.
Tonight we'll be talking of ex-gay counselling. Have you ever heard of it? Or do you know anyone who's been through it? If so, send us a tweet at Father Bob, at John Safran, or at Soipel, S-O-I-P-L, our producer. Up next, though, you'll find out how vulture capitalism is swallowing the world. Stay tuned for Anthony Lowenstein, author of The Prophets of Doom. So let's say hello to Anthony Lowenstein.
Hey, Lowenstein, how are you?
Hey, Safran, how are you? Father Bob?
How are you, Anthony?
I'm good. How are you both?
Looking forward to the book, comrade.
Thank you, sir.
Now, before we get onto the topic of this book, I've seen you on The Drum, on ABC's The Drum quite often, and I'm quite interested in how you've got, like, an opinion on every last thing. Like, do you really, like, because it goes macro and micro, and I kind of understand why you'd be interested in this thing, not, but it just, you know, like, about, like, factions in local politics in the, you know, in New South Wales, like, really? Like, you kind of...
Well, I wouldn't say I'm an expert about, for example, every micro detail, but the nature of the show is that you have to have an opinion about this and that, but obviously I have areas of expertise, put it that way.
And how do you do it when you're kind of, like, I find it hard to have opinions on things when I'm like really like have an expertise in it, such as exorcisms and Scrabble. Whilst you just seem to be able to bang, 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 just out anything.
Hopefully with a degree of quality. Thank you, John. Well, I guess I read widely, but you know, you sort of get given the topics that afternoon of the show, so you have a few hours to read up, to get across why John Safran would make a fantastic Labor leader, you know, and get all the good talking points, and I can go from there.
Sure. Now, Prophets of Doom. By the way, I've got some backup topics if this doesn't get contentious enough.
Hopefully it's about Israel. Go on.
Yeah. The you went on an adventure for this book. You weren't just Googling this, were you? You weren't just sitting there getting fatter, gobbling on donuts and being really impressed with yourself. Like you actually
I'm also on a weight loss program like you.
And you got a bit you got your hands dirty. So
I did.
Where were some of the places you went, and how do they tie in with things young people may buy and purchase in Australia?
I guess the reason behind the book, which has been about 3 years in the making, I'm also doing a film about it as well, a documentary, is to say that in various areas of our lives that affect everyone from young to old, whether it's detention centres for asylum seekers or wars in Afghanistan or aid to Papua New Guinea or Haiti or the resource industry, all those issues I think to some extent affect all of us, or we might think about it now and then, or we see it in the press. Increasingly in the last 30 years, many of those areas have been outsourced to private corporations, and the effect of that has been a lack of accountability, often human rights abuses. And this is not a left or right issue, it's generally a bipartisan issue. So regardless of who's in power in Canberra or Washington or London or elsewhere, both sides of major politics seem to think that, for example, it's a good idea that when we go to war, a lot of the services that we undertake in, say, Iraq and Afghanistan should be run by private corporations. And the problem with that is that too often those corporations are not particularly accountable. They often commit human rights abuses. But even worse, the governments don't seem to really care about it. And I think I wanted to go to all these different countries, the ones you mentioned, and seeing the connections. So often the same corporations are involved. And
name one.
Serco or G4S.
Serco, yep.
Serco or G4S. So G4S is the biggest security company in the world. It's British. And Serco is one of the biggest that's also British.
Oh, do you know why I know all about, what is it, G4S?
G4S, yeah.
Guess why I know about that.
And in fact, you work for them on the side?
No. I think when you walk out of the ABC building there in Sydney, if you go look at the badge on the guy who's minding out there, because it's certainly the ones out here at the desk in Melbourne, they're G4S.
Yeah, quite possibly. I mean, the tasks of G4S are everything from something like that, which is relatively mundane, to something which is far more serious, like, for example, running the detention centre in Manus Island in Papua New Guinea, where Australia has sent refugees in the last year or so. So the problem really with these corporations is that when reports are put out by the British government, the Australian government, the US government, pretty much to a report, they're always saying the corporations are doing terrible things, the staff aren't trained well, they're abusing those in their care, and yet it had little or no effect on them actually getting more contracts. So Serco is one short example. Is a British company which runs all the detention centres in Australia on the mainland and Christmas Island. And despite the fact that in Britain, when they've run equivalent services for either immigrants or other people in that sort of area, their ability to manage those contracts is terrible. And despite that, the Australian government, the Labor government in 2009, and I suspect Abbott as the new Prime Minister will continue this, we'll have to wait and see, the record of these corporations, not just towards asylum seekers, but also towards the guards as well. I spent a lot of time in these centres, and often the guards, and I think I acknowledge my own blind spot here, where I didn't really think as much about the conditions under which these people work in these centres themselves are often struggling with mental trauma and mental harm, which is why often they're suing the government and the corporation for millions and millions of dollars in
now,
the last year.
Can I ask you a question?
Please.
Now, I remember before the internet and stuff, like if someone was a vegetarian, they'd be like, listen, we're going to get cameras in there. And once we get cameras into like an abattoir and we show how awful the conditions are in there, and we'll be able to release it. And once people see this, they'll change and they won't want to eat meat anymore. Mm. And that was always under the pretense before the internet, where you couldn't get all these gory kind of political things out there that, you know, it was going to. But now you can. And everyone can see it, and everyone knows what goes on in abattoirs, and everyone, every so often, you know, even on a fairly mainstream current affairs show, they'll have some thing. But people just, maybe people just don't care. And so what I'm kind of extrapolating that out of what all these things you talk about, maybe you see, you think it's people in authority who are awful, which I agree with, but you see, where I differ from you is I think regular people are pretty awful too. So I think that they don't, like, you're going to go to all this work and show all these horrible things, but because people are awful, they won't care.
That's a very misanthropic view, isn't it, John? I don't really agree with that. I mean, look, of course there are bad people that do terrible things, and there are bad people in every country and every corporation. No, I don't argue that every single person who works for Serco is evil. Not at all. What I'm saying is that I think often there is either willful ignorance. Look, a lot of the public doesn't want to know or don't care. I mean, asylum seekers is a good example, isn't it? Where there's
exactly.
a toxic issue. It's such a toxic issue, and people generally speaking, I'd say there's probably what a sizable majority, or certainly a very vocal minority, who think that we should treat asylum seekers with more cruelty. That view is undoubtedly out there. But we can either accept that or say, well, in fact, the fact that these people are put in private detention centres in the middle of nowhere, often in the middle of a desert, is a problem. And we
but that's a great example, because I don't think, like, that either either of the major parties care that much about being nasty to asylum seekers.
They don't.
Outside of the context of it's good for that's what a sizable portion of the population wants. So it's actually the regular people that are being the jerks here, and it's the leaders who are sort of following, realizing that's where the vote is, because their electorates are full with jerks.
Well, look, there are jerks out there, but that's like arguing that the reason the vast majority of mainstream media is appallingly crap is because no one's demanding anything better. I mean, that's an argument, and I don't generally share that view. There's certainly a market for stuff that talks about, you know, the most exciting washing detergent, and that's fine. But I do think there are people out there, not just left people, but people on the right as well. I mean, America is one short example. There is growing pressure in Republican states to house less people in privately run prisons. And this is not because they care about human rights, because economically it's not working, and they're not finding less people, for example, are taking drugs. So this is actually a shift coming from the left.
There's a great irony in the private prison industry in America, where conservatives, on the one hand, they're really against a welfare state, but private prisons are in some ways like the ultimate welfare state. You're kind of housing and feeding a huge population on taxpayers' money.
And you could say the military is exactly the same way. I mean, the military is almost like the most ideal socialist situation where everything is paid for by the state. But when it comes to private prisons, I talk about this in the book, as listeners may not be aware, often there are lobbyists that work to assist various states and federal governments to draft legislation that means that private prisons must have legally X number of people always in prisons. And that's a bit of a problem for self-evident reasons when it comes to drugs or whatever. And it's often African Americans, of course, who are suffering because of that. And the result, I think, in the last few years is that in particularly Republican conservative states, there's been a bit of a shift. It's pretty minor. America's still got an insane number of people in prison, which you know, John, very well. But it has been a slight shift, and that's not really ideological. It's more an economic one. And I say, well, it's a shame it's not both, but so be it. And I guess what I'm arguing in the book and the film is that I'm not suggesting that everything, if it's run by the public or government, is utopia. Of course, that's not true. But we shouldn't ignore the fact that if we, for example, go to war in Iraq or Afghanistan or Syria or Libya or wherever we may go to war now or in the future, do we care about the fact, or do we want to know more about the fact that the government's using, for example, privatized intelligence or private army forces to do things that are clearly often illegal or morally suspect? I think a lot of people would care about that if they knew.
Now,
some would, some wouldn't.
Anthony Lowenstein, the capitalist, stole the H, but I noticed they put an extra E back into Lowenstein, so it all evens out.
You feel better about that?
Can you please stick with us, because we'll talk more and hopefully have fights.
Sunday Night Safran.
With John Safran and Father Bob Maguire on Triple J.
Still to come tonight, we'll talk about ex-gay therapy for minors. In the US of A, New Jersey has become the second state to outlaw the practice. But in Australia, it seems now, restrictions don't apply. Freelance journalist Luke Williams will be joining us with more details, so stay tuned for that. Plus, you'll meet the Queen of Crime and Rule in another slice of John Safran's True Crime series. But we're going to continue with this magnificent interview between John Safran and Anthony Lowenstein.
Hey, Anthony Lowenstein, how are you?
Hey, Jonathan Safran.
Now, what do you think of things like WikiLeaks? They didn't go that well at the election, or as well as was hope.
Very true. I thought the party was a bit of a disaster, to be honest, and it was a shame, but it was an absolute catastrophe because it was managed badly and the preferences was done badly, and I think people were turned off. And it was a mess, and I hope that they learned their lesson, is the short answer.
And now, what was the mess? Were they too clever by halves by trying to do all this preference dealing?
Possibly.
And it kind of damaged the brand. So apparently, I don't quite have my head around it, but apparently you do little horse trades with other little parties, and it can really help increase your vote because of the voting system. So, for instance, that's why that guy who's into motor cars kind of got into the Senate. It's not like he got more votes than WikiLeaks. It's that he did all this clever little trading. And do you think WikiLeaks damaged the brand by Australia isn't at the point where they're going to, or the type of people who are going to vote for WikiLeaks in Australia aren't at this point in their heads where they're kind of going to go, oh, well, you know, I understand these shooting parties are for freedom too, so... Yeah. Just like the Greens are, the Australian mentality just isn't there like it may be there in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, I say this as someone who supported WikiLeaks, written about them, talked about them since 2006 when they started. But I think the problem with this was it was pretty rushed. The key people didn't have a lot of experience. And I think the problem sometimes with politics is that we only have people who are professional. So the idea of people who are a bit different is good. However, when you don't have transparency in the process of how preferences worked, when you preference right-wing parties, and you preference in WA, for example, against someone like Scott Ludlam, who's a Greens senator who has been your key supporter in the Australian Parliament in the last 3 years, that's insane. And when you get questioned on that and you're not very defensive about it, when you have key candidates, Leslie Cannell...
Because it's not even a moral thing. It's like a branding thing. It's like it's so bad for the brand for what they did in WA that there better be this huge other benefit, and there kind of wasn't.
Certainly hope so. Well, there doesn't seem to be. And the problem is, unless there is some kind of accountability both internally and externally to sort of show that if they want to continue, which they apparently do, and they want to run in 3 years, that they actually have got their shit together and they're actually a bunch better organised. I mean, I would have voted for them. I wrote a column for The Guardian. I wrote a few months ago before this happened that I would consider voting for them in the Senate in New South Wales, where I live. But alas, when all this stuff came out, I simply couldn't. I know some of the people involved, and they're good people with good politics, in my view. But there were certain powers that be in there, I think, that were undermining the transparency, and therefore they couldn't be supported. And their vote was far less than it could have been. So, yeah, not ideal.
Now, can I tell you a true story?
Please.
I'm on Facebook. And a very prominent member of the BD, I don't want to get it wrong because it sounds like bondage, not the BDSM, the Bondage Divestment Sanctions, BDS.
Even BDS, Boycott, Divestment, Sanction against
Israel. Oh, yeah, that's right, sorry, against Israel. Anyway, a very prominent head. I won't mention his name because I sort of don't want to inflame things, if you know what I mean. So you're going to just have to trust me that this is all true. He'd put a picture of this cafe that wasn't Max Brenner, just a small local cafe, and had said that it was an Israeli-owned cafe, and talked about how this Palestinian-Australian had gone in there, and when she saw that on the menu was Israeli breakfast, she went up and said, "What the heck? Why have you got Israeli breakfast?" And it's like, oh, you know, the people are Israeli. And anyway, so shit went down. I don't think anything too bad. But anyway, she huffed off. Anyway, and then this prominent member of the movement had posted a picture of it. And then everyone, you know, all the people had climbed on board and said, oh, this is outrageous at this Israeli blah. And
I think yet, I read about that.
Blah, 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 blah. And I said, that photo looks really familiar. And I'm going, that's this little cafe that's around the corner from my flat. So I thought, and then I thought to myself, it's a really small cafe. I find it difficult to believe that for some reason there's Israelis that are running this local cafe. More likely, it will be Israeli immigrants to Australia. In other words, Australians. So I walked around the corner and I went in there to find out. Uh-huh. And not only was it owned by the children of immigrants who had come to Australia, whatever, like 15 years ago, 20 years ago, right. or whatever. I just thought that was...
I think I read about that story, actually. I mean, look, just for the record, for those who are wondering, BDS generally does not believe, and not that I support it and I talk about it publicly, but doesn't the idea that someone is Israeli does not mean that it should be boycottable. The issue is a connection to the Israeli state in some kind of way or an institution. So the fact that there's an Israeli, some connection, they have an Israeli breakfast, that's not a reason to boycott. People can
go to a cafe. These were like Israeli immigrants. So it just seems, yeah, right. it seems weird that sort of like that in a movement that on the one hand says, oh, if an asylum seeker boat arrives in Australia, oh, you know, we should like let them in and, you know, and they're pretty much Australian. But then if someone's an Israeli Australian, they're somehow not an Australian.
Yeah, well, if those are all the facts that you've given, and that's what I recall reading as well, then I don't support that. I mean, I don't know what else to say apart from that, you know, boycotting an organisation or institution, a university or some kind of military tie or an arms industry or a performer who goes to Israel, not to Palestine, for example, to me is legitimate. And that was what was used against South African apartheid. But, you know, the idea of boycotting an Israeli cafe in Jewville in Melbourne, don't you?
Yeah.
Around there is ridiculous. I mean, it's crazy. And I don't support that at all. So people supporting that out there, they shouldn't.
Okay. Well,
you're surprised by my response, are you?
No, well, you know, I was trying to. That was my fight that I was going to have.
Sorry, I wasn't going to buy into that. No, I think that's ridiculous, and I think the problem is that it therefore blurs the line between someone who is legitimately believing that Israel should be boycotted for its human rights abuses against Palestinians, and those who just are being targeted because they happen to be Israelis. I mean, some of whom have good politics and some who have bad politics. But nuance is key, isn't it, Mr. Safran?
It is. Okay, what else can we fight against? Are you against black people or gays or anything?
No, I'm a big supporter of both of them. I think they have. I think full rights is pretty important there. And even Jews. I think Jews really deserve to get full rights now too. We've made it.
Now, you went to Haiti.
I did.
Now, when do you...
I'm going back there actually soon. Yeah.
You're going back there. Now, what do you do? You see, you're coming from a way more political perspective than me. Like, I'm just a storyteller, right? So if I, like, go over, like I did, to Mississippi, sorry to bore everyone, and, like, I meet jerks who are, like, yeah. part of a minority group, or, yeah. you know, it just doesn't matter, because I'm, like, telling a story. So the fact that people have flaws and that's fine to me, but you're going over there and you're trying to build this picture of that there's kind of goodies and baddies, and surely you must just always in your journeys just meet jerks from the groups that you're meant to be the advocate for. Like, you're just meeting these Haitians that are, yeah, I say jerks because I don't want to swear anymore, if you know what I mean, but they're like a-holes or something, you know what I mean? That's as far as I'll go.
No, I don't know if I agree with you. I mean, I think you sound like you come to the position that says that most people are going to be pricks unless they convince you otherwise, right? I mean, that sounds like what you're saying. Is that what you think about people?
No, it's not what I think. It's a real. Are you telling me that if I walk out in the street now,
yeah,
that and I kind of like talk around about like you reckon most of the people like there's not going to be jerks among them?
Oh, I'd almost guaranteed. Probably that is the case. But I mean, in Haiti, for example, what I was looking at there was the way that Haiti obviously is an independent nominally, but is really a U.S. sort of client state. And obviously over the 20th century, the U.S. backed countless dictators. And now there's a sort of quasi-democracy there, sort of. But the way the U.S. has been supporting Haiti is through with the Obama administration, through Hillary Clinton. Obviously, she's not Secretary of State anymore. But when she was after the earthquake in 2010, which I was there after that, and you see this mass destruction, particularly through Port-au-Prince, which is the capital, that the way that Haiti was going to be saved, inverted commas, was through sweatshops that were going to be making clothes for Walmart, Kmart, etc. And you have some Haitians who are supporting that. But the vast bulk of Haitians are not getting anything from that, and they're not seeing much of the aid, despite the fact the US and other countries, including our own, through aid groups have given billions and billions. And one of the things I try to talk about in the book in relation to Haiti, PNG and elsewhere is the argument, for example, that more aid is always good is actually not the answer here. That in so many cases, aid certainly assists, say, maternal health or important areas of life that I think we have a way to assist. But too often that aid either goes to Western contractors who are making a fortune, too often it's going to corrupt officials in the countries itself, and too often it doesn't actually go to assisting local people or infrastructure. So when all these groups leave, which they do inevitably, what's actually left? And you see that in Haiti. It's just this sort of, not saying everything is appalling there. There is certainly rays of light and there are people who are resisting it, but people just get ground down, same in PNG. So no, I found a lot of Haitians were friendly. Some people were quite threatening. Some don't like the fact that you visit. Some were incredibly welcoming. So there was all sorts of people. But I guess I generally, I'm not saying I see the good in everybody. I mean, I've traveled to enough places, as have you, to realize that a lot of people are not very good. But I guess I do come from the position, I do think the majority of people, and maybe obviously we disagree about this, are probably essentially all wanting roughly the same thing, which is the basics. And I think...
You see, this is why you get on the drum and I don't, because you say things like that that really like tie up in a neat little bow and sound good, whilst I'm here like squeaking about how this Haitian...
The world's full of terrible people.
Yeah, Haitians are jerks or whatever.
I don't even know why you say that, though. I mean...
No, I don't mean Haitians particularly. I just meant people.
Yes, people in general.
Yeah. Yeah, I just meant people, any Haitians listening. Now...
But you must have found nice people.
No, I did. I did find. No, I have found nice people. You're right. You're right. I guess we're just after different things, you know.
That's why I'm glad that you're doing what you're doing.
Anthony Lowenstein, thank you very much for joining us.
Prophet of Zoom.
When is your book coming out? Quickly.
The book is out. It's out now.
And when's the film coming out?
The film is a work in progress and it should be out next year.
Okay, so you'll be hitting us all up on Kickstarter.
And there's a digital edition.
Yes, there's a Kickstarter campaign at the moment. If you go to kickstarter.com and type in my name, it's about 20... it's a work in progress, yes.
Thank you. Don't run off with the money, Anthony Lowenstein.
Thank you.
Sunday Night Saffron. Triple J.
Soon you'll find out what sexuality education some Australian school kids are getting. Freelance journalist Luke Williams will be coming in to talk about ex-gay counselling in Aussie schools. Plus more from John Safran's true crime series. Anne Rule, the author of The Stranger Beside Me, will share the eerie story of serial killer Ted Bundy. You're listening to Triple J this Sunday night, a Safran with me, Bob McGuire, and John Safran's in charge.
Now, speaking of the radio, dear listener, like you are lying there under your doona at the moment, a lot of you, I know some of you are driving around in your Datsun Sunnies and other assorted rust buckets. And some of you might just be listening in the little white buds on the train or something. But anyway, I was lying in bed like you are, under the doona, listening to my new digital radio set because I thought I have to, because I'm in the scene, because I'm in the game, I might as well get a digital radio, these things that everyone's talking about, because you can get those stations that you can't get on the regular dial.
Vatican Radio.
Dig, ABC's Dig.
Dig.
Or Unearth. You can get that on the digital. And I thought, you know, anyway, so I'm pretty happy that after all these years, like I'm lying there listening to the crisp, golden digital sound, because they sell it as, you know, it's digital quality and or whatever, right? So I'm lying there, I'm thinking, I might Google on my smartphone, because obviously it's better quality. How much better quality is digital radio to regular FM radio? So I pull up my smartphone and bloop, 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 and then I look at all the information and it's worse quality than FM. And it's not like, this isn't like controversial or like a conspiracy, like I'm into lizard people plus digital radio. Apparently the advantage of digital radio is you get more stations. Plus, if you can't get good reception, there's locations where you can get a crisper sound from digital, because you don't get that little static in the background, like... But apparently, if you have two radios, if you've got like just, if you're in some place where you can get like perfect FM radio, it's actually better quality, the FM, than the digital, man.
You told us last week
that that's not the advantage
of digital was far greater.
Well, it kind of depends.
Have you told us last week?
I know. I didn't know. But the thing is, it's slightly complicated because if you do get a bit of a crackle, like you don't get the crackle with the digital, right? But assuming you don't get the crackle, apparently it's just, you know, it's better. And there's no, it's not a controversy, because it's like, it's that old MP, it's like they compress it to kind of send it out into the universe or whatever. So they're suddenly, I'm there listening.
No, I
listening.
Lived off that. I lived off that for a whole week, you see.
So if you're listening to me on digital, I actually sound like squeakier than if you're listening to me on FM. I thought it would have been the other way around. Can we talk about something else, something more newsworthy?
In that advertisement with the man driving and the other man sitting there and he's saying, that radio is playing such and such.
Mm-hmm.
He then says to the radio, would you mind playing the last track of blah, blah, blah?
What?
Now, is it a fact that the radio listens to you and plays back what you have asked for?
When the radio listens to you, have you been reading David Icke's again?
I'm in the car the other day. Yeah. I'm driving. There's a man beside me with his phone. The tune comes through the radio.
What?
He says, one moment.
Yes.
He points the phone at
the
radio.
Oh, that's Shazam.
The thing tells him
what's
being played.
Yes, that's Shazam. That's Shazam.
Well, I'm going a step.
Can I just tell you, you can do things with Shazam that, like,
I stopped the car
Jesus,
and got out,
you know,
and took the tram.
With the average smartphone, he's better than anything that your man did in the New Testament, basically. Like, you know, you can hold up this and then know what the song is from anywhere in the world.
Can you tell the wireless?
Can you tell
the wireless? Thank you for playing that track. Would you
why,
mind
why
playing?
Do you want to talk to the radio unless
you're mad?
Well,
that's
what
you're doing when you're telling the bloody radio that you point the phone at the radio.
Before I get all these pedants, and no doubt I've unleashed
the
pedants.
You started this with this.
No.
FM
no, this is the thing. Apparently, in theory, digital radio could be the most, like, wonderful thing.
That's what you said last week.
But all the stations have decided, so they can fit more things onto the dial, to not send out the kind of best...
So, yeah.
Blah.
You sure that's not a conspiracy?
Imagine if this is the thing that finally gets me into trouble. Like, because this is like a real delicate situation, like with Mark Scott, the head of the ABC.
Exactly.
They're trying to release, like, brainwash everyone into.
Yeah, but you're saying there's a vulture corporation.
It's pretty, but you don't get Unearth and you don't get Dig and you don't get all the others if you don't go to
digital. But you get better quality of what you've got.
Mm.
You're listening to Sunday Night Safran with John Safran and Father Bob McGuire on Triple J.
Now, there was a shooting, Navy Yard shooter, in Fort Worth,
Aaron Alexis,
Texas. And, of course, one of the interesting things that came out was that he used to go to a Buddhist temple quite often.
Mm. So, but the Buddhist, what are you going to make up
out
of this?
Well, it's just like, once again, something that if it was... You know, he went to a mosque.
Yes.
That would be like this big thing. But if you go to the Buddhist, how do they do it every time they get off the hook? And no one's like, well, what's happening there with that, you know, that wheel of ghost, spirit wheel, that's making people want to go on shooting rampages.
Mm. Yeah, all right.
The Burmese government, Buddhist, they don't get in trouble. It's like, what's wrong with Buddhism that it can make a country like Burma? Like they say, what's wrong with Islam? It can make a country like Saudi Arabia. And then this guy shoots, and then they find out he goes to a Buddhist thing, and he gets... Well, how do they do it? They've got the best brand sort of out there, Father Bob.
So you are a great lover of the US of A.
Yes.
Is it not true that that bunch of citizens are more armed than any other bunch of citizens in the world?
I don't know.
You don't know?
No.
What convenient not to know.
I'm not trying to hide it, man. Yeah, but okay, let's
and
say
my
yes.
My question is then why... And then you give the simplistic answer that the Constitution says we can, therefore we do, in case the government comes to take us away.
Correct.
We can shoot them all in the street.
Correct.
But do they really, after all this time, all Obama can get up and say, listen, we better get used to this ritual once every 2 or 3 months because we're going to have them over and over again.
Well, you of course know that the real, most of the deaths aren't caused by gun massacres. It's sort of micro. It's like one by
is
one.
It?
Yes. Like street crime.
Most of them are drive-bys.
Well, I'm not saying drive-bys. Why do you always... No, most gun homicides are like one-on-one, like murder. It's more of a micro gang problem than it is a shooting massacre problem. Now, you're listening to Triple J. Coming up next, we're going to be talking to Luke about deprogramming gay people. So if you're gay and you don't want to be gay anymore, You better stick around, dear listener. You're listening to me and Bob on Triple J.
And don't listen to digital, for God's sake. Put on FM.
Sunday Night Safran on Triple J.
Later on, you'll hear more from John Safran's true crime series. This week, you'll meet Anne Rule, otherwise dubbed the Queen of Crime, who'll share her story about serial killer Ted Bundy. And next, freelance journalist Luke Williams will give the lowdown of ex-gay therapy in Aussie schools. This is Sunday Night Safran. Joining us right now from our Bundaberg studios in Queensland is freelance journalist and law student Luke Williams, who's written an investigative article on ex-gay therapy in Australian schools.
Hey, Luke, how are you?
Hey, I'm good. Thanks for having me back on the program. I was a bit surprised, actually, that I was allowed back on, because last time I was on, you looked particularly bored, John.
Oh, really?
What
were you talking about?
There you go. Doesn't that just say everything?
Go on.
But I remember Father Bob couldn't keep his eyes off me, and then I was like, oh, now I see. Now I see what's going on here.
See, look at this.
I'm definitely interested in this, let me tell you. So you went and investigated what precisely?
Well, I was looking at the work of one guy, Hayden Sennett, who did work for a ministry called Liberty Ministries that assists people, they say, in reducing their desires for the same sex. And I was under the understanding that he was going into some schools in Western Sydney, and we managed to find out he was going into one school in particular called Toon Gabby, which is just west of Parramatta.
So hang on, not to give away the... Did you have to go undercover like in 21 Jump Street, where you had to dress up as a school student even though you're out of school, and for this story?
No, I didn't have to go. I didn't have to go undercover. We managed to get this information from a source, which I'm not at liberty to discuss who that source is. But we did manage to find out that he's gone into the school on three occasions, including to a parent-teacher information night, and where he gave his story about how he once used to go into public toilets around Sydney and engage in sexual activity with men. No longer does, and now has a Korean wife and several kids. And that you can do that too.
Is this a private school or a state school?
This is a state school, but this is a religious school. So,
school, you mean? Or something? What's a state religious school?
It is a religious school that receives government funding. So, yes,
there's a lot of them.
Yeah. Okay. Mm. And so, and what did you have? Did you go and see one of his talks in action?
I didn't, but I was under the understanding from our source that he spoke about the sinfulness of homosexuality and how that there is a trend towards accepting homosexuality that is at odds with the Christian doctrine, and that it is wrong to think that just because you are attracted to the same sex that means you automatically assume the gay identity.
And why do you reckon the school was letting him in? Do you think it's one of these things that they really had a dog in the fight, and they wanted to bring him in actively and him to be a big talker at part of the school? Or was it more like there's this schmo that's like one of many people who's trying to speak to the kids, and over the year 100 people speak to them and he happens to be one?
Well, it was my understanding that he went to several schools with an offer to talk to them, and this was the only one that took him up on the offer. They say, yes, there is a range of different speakers that we come and speak to this school, but it's interesting that they were the only one to accept his offer. Why in particular they wanted him to speak, I'm not sure, but I think it is interesting that it is part of a far-right reactionary movement against the greater acceptance of homosexuality. So we have groups like Hillsong that I guess you could say are on the centre-right, which have now put out statements saying that we don't believe in ex-gay therapy, we don't believe people that can change their sexual orientation, and that it is in fact harmful. And then we have these far-right reactionary Christian groups.
So hang on, I got confused there. So Hillsong don't think it's harmful to be gay, or they do?
Sorry, they think it is harmful
to try to deprogram people. Okay,
yeah,
cool.
Yeah. Whereas these far-right reactionary groups actually seem to be becoming more aggressive, and the academic research is showing that 33% of same-sex attracted students in Western Sydney have been exposed to the message in those schools that they can change or should change their sexuality or should in fact abstain from their same-sex desires, which is a huge number, especially when you compare that with the growing acceptance of homosexuality in mainstream society.
And how did your friend, the talker, how did he deprogram himself, or how was he deprogrammed from being gay? Did he just
Hayden Sennett? He felt terribly guilty about it. He talks about it a lot on his blog, actually, and he began to see his life, I guess, as some kind of Sodom and Gomorrah type situation, and that. He was standing outside his local church, and he just felt that it was wrong, and that it was time to change. And that he then went through a process where he tried to act more masculine and deepened his voice. And he might be able to help you, John, actually. And and he said that people started respecting him more, and that his life changed. And he met this girl online, and whilst he doesn't seem to be sexually attracted to her, he has a deep friendship with her, and they got married, and he feels like that has opened up the key to a better afterlife, I guess.
And what about, did he, like, you know, how Bob Brown got electrodes put to his temples? Mm-hmm. Did this guy get anything like that done, or was it all just... Did he do it all by himself, or did he see a priest or anything?
No, my understanding is that he did it all by himself, and that he got a little bit of counselling. The way ex-gay therapy now, I guess it's a lot more moderate than what it once was, in that people, it's just about talking therapies and going to groups, and a lot of it is based on the idea that you can sublimate your homosexual desire by being around men a lot in a platonic setting, or hugging them, or in one case, one practitioner suggests that you have a bath with members of the same sex in a platonic way in order to sublimate your desires for the same sex.
Wait till I've never had a platonic bath with anyone. You know what I mean?
Well, it's counterintuitive, to say the least, isn't it?
Now, and what did you find out about Bob Brown therapy? Because that sounds like really weird to our 2013 ears to hear that Bob Brown, or anyone indeed, was lying there and had like electrodes put on him, and that was somehow meant to de-gay him.
Yeah, electric shock therapy went on in the 60s and 70s. There was a trend. The idea that somebody can change their gay orientation has a history that starts in the 19th century, when this modern idea of being gay started. And it's sort of come in and out of fashion. It came back in fashion after the Second World War, when I guess people felt like life was more precarious, and that people needed to breed, and people were generally a lot more conservative. So around that time, there was a lot of thinking around different methods to change sexual orientation. A lot of it was, reused. A lot of the practices that were used in Nazi Germany around that time, and of course in Nazi Germany they used brain surgery in some cases, frontal lobotomies, to try and stop people from being gay. And then come the early 1970s, it was removed in the context of the New Left and the rise of the idea of individual liberties. It was removed from the DSM, and it has
the DSM. Just, that's that psychology that's saying what's a mental illness and what isn't.
Yeah, that's right. The Dictionary of the American Psychiatric Association. It was removed from that DSM, and ever since then, the whole ex-gay movement has been a fringe type movement that some people have gone to. And I guess there's an argument to say that if you're a consenting adult and you don't wish to be attracted to the same sex, then you have a right to go to those groups. But as Father Bob mentioned earlier, there are now some jurisdictions in the United States where it is not legal for a licensed therapist to practice ex-gay therapy on a minor. And now in the context of this story and growing revelations that minors are going into ex-gay groups in Australia, there are calls for regulation of that.
Well, thank you very much for informing us all on this. Is there any last things you need to get out?
Well, Hayden Sennett has mentioned that he thinks that Bob Brown is a member of the Illuminati.
So, hang on, we should have led with that. Why is this like the last thing? That should have been like the opening salvo in which we spent the... Say, he's a member of the Illuminati. What kind of Illuminati? Like, how does he define the Illuminati?
He doesn't mention the Illuminati, but there's different... you mentioned David Icke before. David Icke is someone who thinks the Illuminati are lizards from another planet. A lot of people believe in the Illuminati, but there are different theories on who the Illuminati are. Mm. Some people think that they're Jewish. Some people think that they're Catholic. Some people think that they're gay. So, in fact, we might all be part of the Illuminati right now.
I know, and we're using that reverse psychology thing where everyone's listening going, there's no way they just admit to it like
that's
that.
Right.
They must be joking. So, yeah. But he
suggests that the reason that Bob Brown is opposed to what Hayden practices is because he's part of the Illuminati, a secret elite society that runs all the big corporations and government in the world, including the media. You wouldn't think that, even if you were to buy into the conspiracy theorist's viewpoint, you wouldn't necessarily think that Bob Brown would be someone who would fit with the Illuminati.
But that's exactly what they want to believe.
Yeah,
you've put your finger on it.
Anyway, we're going to go to a song and then do our secret handshake. Thank you very much for joining us, Luke.
Thanks so much for having me again.
And I wish you could see me eye to eye, because you're, of course, in another studio, and see how unbored I was during that whole thing.
Yes, he was animated.
And you've been getting into fitness, I see, as well, which is great to see.
You saw how I was kind of letting myself fall apart a bit,
not at all.
As soon as I kind of wasn't filming on TV, yes. Anyway, thank you very much, Luke. And dear listener, if you want to find out more about gay therapy that we discussed with Luke Williams, go to the globalmail.org site and poke around there.
Sunday Night Safran
on Triple J.
With me, Bob McGuire, and John Safran's in charge. Shortly you'll hear more from John Safran's true crime series. Stay tuned for the story of serial killer Ted Bundy. Jono?
Bob, I was watching a credit card commercial for a major bank, and it was already kind of like being kind of rubbing me up the wrong way. You know me, I'm not really judgmental, like, about vices. Like, I try to err on the side of, you know, let people have fun or whatever. Anyway, but this ad was like winding me up, because it was all trying to encourage you. It was saying, oh, you don't think you can afford to buy this and this and that? Well, what about the credit card? Because now you can buy it now and you've got 5 months to pay.
Of course.
I just thought, you know, like, it just seemed really slightly obnoxious, you know, and just in your face. And then I noticed the tune in the background, and it was O Come All Ye Faithful. I think it was because O Come All Ye Faithful has been Weird Al Yankovized by Aussies into
right.
Why Are We Waiting?
All right.
And like why do we have to wait for something? We should have instant gratification now.
Mm.
And do you reckon if there is a Christian, if there's a God,
yes,
and basically
this is getting interesting.
Spirit realm is as
yes.
laid out in your testament, do you reckon the copywriter and maybe the people at the bank are in a bit of trouble when in the afterlife for taking the song about Christ the Lord and using it as a backdrop to try to encourage
a fertile imagination? Yeah, go on.
Try to
look,
cash poor Australians
don't
into buying stuff they can't afford.
Sleeping in their little doonas, as you say. Don't worry them about these things. There's nothing there. Where'd you get that from? I never heard that.
The what?
Come, we are waiting. Where was that?
Why are we waiting? I think it's like a thing at the cricket, for instance.
Oh, I see what you mean. Right.
Like when you, if you don't think it's moving
along.
No,
I don't think so. But you reckon they shouldn't pillage religious or semi-religious songs?
Well, even if you're an atheist, right?
Mm.
Like maybe if you're passing by like a cemetery, right?
Yes.
Like why not just walk all over the graves? Why not? Why not?
All right.
But you're sort of like, even atheists are kind of going, do I really want to mess with the spirit realm?
So do they, or do they say just bad manners?
Yeah, well, probably, but you know, it just seems like you're really tempting fate. Like you really want to really make sure that there's no God and no Christian spirit realm before you nick the song about Christ the Lord and put it in your credit card commercial.
Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. See, most of those have been nicked anyway.
Wait.
They've been nicked.
You sound like Leonard Cohen.
They've been nicked anyway, you see.
Jingle bells.
Silent night.
Sunday Night Saffron.
With John Saffron and Father Bob Maguire on Triple J.
Did you hear about Golden Dawn? Now, Golden Dawn are a Greek nationalist group. They've sprung up.
Oh, the Iron Fist and all that.
They're considered a fascist group, and people are worried about them in Europe.
Dear, dear, dear.
And they're saying that a left-wing hip-hop artist by the name of Killer P, who's a Greek hip-hop artist who was against them, has been murdered by one of them.
Don't say that. Is that true?
Yeah. Killer P, his full name is Pavlos Fissas.
Yeah.
And, what more do you
Killed
want
by the Golden Dawn.
Yes, that they saw him out. And they, they just killed him.
That's not nice, is it?
No, it's not nice.
There's a bit of that going on everywhere.
The other weird thing is, I mean, who knows what these things add up to? But you know that, and it's you know how like often these things, like for instance, I've gone out somewhere and there's meant to be like this big clan group or whatever, and you end up there and it's like two guys in a room.
Mm.
So, but you do know that there's talk that Golden Dawn is getting like there's little enclaves in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
Because of
amongst the Greek population.
Yeah, because it's like that weird thing of like, oh, that's my identity, mate.
Yes, of course.
It's my identity.
Course.
And so like the whole weird, like, what you know, paradoxes of like, if you were that much of a nationalist, why are you in Australia and not in Greece? Like that doesn't get involved. And also the Greek community obviously being an immigrant community, so... Why?
Yeah, the Syrian who went back to Syria.
Yeah, so
and
but
he was
regardless
shot.
Of that, so apparently that because there's just little offices setting up in Australia. I don't know what but as I said, it's probably like two dudes in a room,
and
all
still,
their and all their Greek friends are like, you know, why are you being such?
Or yeah. are there as we kept reminding about Alexis, the Mashuta, there were red flags. We should have noticed the red flag when he rang the police and said,
the Buddha
I heard
shooter.
All of that. Now, maybe that's the same with this. Are there little red flags showing on the? Have we got an overriding
a
security organisation in Australia?
To protect us.
That's watching us, watching over us.
G4S or G4S.
Little red flags?
The
popping up beside the Golden Dawn?
You sound like you're on LSD.
Well, you're the one who's made all this conspiracy theory. I'm worrying who's looking after us.
Sunday Night Saffron.
Triple J.
Hey, I was listening to Hack during the week, and
yes.
they were talking about ICE, and they definitely allow fairly, like, basically they just let anyone on to, like, talk. I don't know what we're worried about having, because I always thought, oh, are we... doing the wrong thing, being on Triple J.
Yes.
And like, for instance, 2 weeks ago, we just have these white nationalists.
Yes.
Going, banging on for 15 minutes.
Yeah, but you reckon...
About why the Triple J audience should actually, if they're thinking of embracing multiculturalism, not only reject it, but perhaps, like, go out in white packs and form a master race.
Yes.
So I was, like, thinking, like, are we going to get in trouble for this? But I was listening to Hack. And, like, they just have, like people ring up going, oh, yeah, so I've been taking ICE. I take it like twice a week, but I'm really careful with it. Yeah. And when I take ICE, Tom Tilly, what I do, I always make sure I have a Mars bar, so I know I've got enough food in me for this. And he just lets on all these people that make our white supremacists just seem like a total like normal.
Yeah.
We're gonna have to up the ante.
Yeah, right.
Listen, Tom Tilly, you might think
you've
won the battle by having all the pro ICE people who eat Mars bars and advocating for the Triple J listeners to take ICE, but we'll be back with something bigger
and better
next week. Yeah,
but we have got the monopoly on lizards.
No.
I don't know if many of the others talk lizards.
We're the only show that endorses
Blue
believing there's a Freemason lizard conspiracy. You are right, Father Bob. Now, stick around. Hey, Tom Tilly, guess what we've got next? Oh gosh, we've just got something on serial killers. Try topping that at the Hack next week. Now, by the way, Ted Mundy, look at the numbers he's got of serial killers. You can try to top that, but he was one of the top killers of killers. So, Tom, you're going to have to dig deep. Well, these metaphors seem like really wrong.
Dig deep is, I think they're not appropriate.
To try to outdo us. But anyway, topping the Hack, coming up next, we have killers, serial killers, here on Triple J.
You're listening to Sunday Night Safran with John Safran and Father Bob Maguire on Triple J.
Time for John Safran's True Crime Series. Here's this week's offering.
John Safran is back from Mississippi, where he bashed out his own fat true crime paperback. Now he's comparing notes with the biggest names in true crime in the world.
Do you mind the expression, the queen of true crime? Is that...
Not at all.
We have got Anne Rule, who people who are into true crime will be like, how did you get Anne Rule? But we have got her. She's the author of The Stranger Beside Me, the shocking inside story of serial killer Ted Bundy that was released in 1980. And it's got an incredible backstory, which explains why so many people love it. And it sort of, it spawned its sort of own style of true crime book in which a lot of other people try their hardest to replicate. Thank you so much for joining us from Seattle, Anne Rule.
It's a real pleasure to be with you.
Now, Ted Bundy, I imagine there'll be like 20-year-olds in Australia who will need to hear a little bit about who this man was and I guess how you then intersected in his life.
Well, this is one of those things that is so strange, you think it's fiction. I volunteered at the Crisis Clinic Suicide Hotline in Seattle back in the early 70s. My background was that I'd grown up in law enforcement family with sheriffs and detectives and judges and prosecutors, and I had been a Seattle policewoman. So we were partnered with a student who I think they got paid $2 an hour then. So every Sunday night and every Tuesday night, I worked all night long with a very nice young man who was going to law school. His name was Theodore Bundy. And so Ted and I were locked up in this big old building that looked like the house in Psycho, all alone together all night long. And we saved a lot of lives. Now, at the same time, I was writing for Fact Detective magazines, churning out probably 1 to 2 stories every week, true cases of mostly murder. I never detected anything bizarre at all about my partner at the Crisis Clinic. Young women were being either plain disappeared beginning in the early 70s, and one of them, he'd given the name Ted. Well, certainly I didn't think it would be my Ted that I knew. However, I'd written a couple thousand magazine articles, but I hadn't really written a book yet. And so I decided I'm going to send in a proposal to a publisher to see if I could get a contract to write about the unknown Ted. Lo and behold, in 1974, I got a phone call from Utah, and it was Ted Bundy. And he said, I'm in a little trouble. I said, well, what's going on? And he said, were you aware that women are disappearing up in Washington? And I said, yeah, and I have a contract, in fact, to write a book about it. He said, well, they're questioning me, and I don't know what to tell them. So in the fullness of time, Ted Bundy became the prime suspect as the serial killer, Ted. I remember the New York Times reviewer said she didn't believe that it had happened that way. It sounded too contrived. Well, it would have been if it was fiction. And I stayed in touch with him until he died in the electric chair in 1989.
As you say, an absolute incredible story. And I guess one aspect to it was that he kept on being able to get away from law enforcement. I think it was twice even he escaped. And did you ever feel like you were in danger?
Somewhat, yes. At the time, I was writing a movie in Hollywood. And I got notification that Ted had escaped. And this was New Year's Eve, 1974. And the FBI said, if you hear from Ted, we think he may head for you because you've been like a sister or mother friend to him. And they said, just act naturally, take him to a restaurant, then we'll come in and arrest him. So I was a little nervous because I was living in West Hollywood in an apartment where I had to walk through dark alleyways and not lighted. But he did not show up there. And he was on a campus, and he cut a killing swath through the campus in Florida. And I got another call from him there. So it still baffles me after all this time, and he's been dead for so long, that I didn't spot the aberrants, but I sure didn't. The first time he escaped was about 6 months before that. He had escaped from jail.
And is that when he escaped from the prison library or the courthouse library?
Yeah.
Were you surprised? Because obviously reading this book, there's so many surprises. And one of them is you can't believe that they've captured someone who's suspected of being this serial killer. Like, they let him escape. It's, like, baffling. Were you surprised when you heard that he'd escape?
Yes, I was. Up until that time, the term serial killer hadn't even been coined. We didn't understand that genre of murder. And I don't think anybody realized how dangerous he was. But he was very intelligent.
And you go into his past and when he was growing up, and he had a bit of an what's the word I'm looking for? Not unbalanced, but unsettled kind of upbringing where he didn't quite know who his parents were. And do you think that fed into it? It seems like when I read a lot of true crime books, and even in the one I research for myself, that the unsettled family background seems to be the recurring thing.
I think that happens a lot. Now, the question here is, I don't believe in the bad seed, but I think there is a tendency for a child to be musical or athletic or a mathematical genius, maybe somewhat genetic. He was told his mother was his big sister, and there were different stories about who his father was. But in reality, I think he was fathered by his grandfather, and the grandfather was a horror. Just fascinated with sadism and pornography, and shared a lot of this with little Ted. I think it just exploded exponentially with that genetic theme doubled and redoubled in an incestuous child.
And he didn't immediately confess to you, did he? Did he claim he was innocent to you when he first contacted you?
He always claimed he was innocent to me.
Oh, really? Even And so did you ever believe him? I always get tricked into things quite easily. If someone tells me something, I can't believe anyone would lie, and I just believe it.
Well, and I'm that way too. After all, 34 books about sadistic sociopaths, I think I believed him at first because I thought, well, we had to pass a very stringent psychological test to be allowed to be at the crisis clinic and giving advice. And I thought, well, gee, I passed it. Either that says Ted's okay or there's something wrong with me. And everybody at the crisis clinic liked him and felt this was a young man who had places to go and worlds to conquer.
Because he was very smart and he was very good looking, and women liked him. So it's not that stereotype that you think about the kind of men who stalk women.
No. I didn't think of Ted as that good looking. In those days, I didn't look at men younger than I was. Now I do all the time because most men are. It just, I thought of him as a little brother. And I didn't see this handsome guy, but I sure met a lot of women who did. And even after he was in prison and after he was executed, I had to get my phone number changed. Because all these sobbing women would call me up and want to talk about how Ted was really a good person.
Wow. Now, you've got this passage. I'll just read a paragraph from The Stranger Beside Me. Ted came into my life at a time when all the beliefs I had held smugly for many years had been shattered. True love, marriage, fidelity, selfless motherhood, blind trust, all those marvelous truths were suddenly only wisps of smoke blowing away in a totally unforeseen gust of wind. But Ted seemed to embody what was young, idealistic, clean, sure, and empathetic. So what was going on in your life that sort of made you open to someone like Ted?
Well, I was getting divorced, and I had four children that I had to support. My about-to-be ex-husband had cancer. I had always trusted that he was faithful, and he wasn't from the first month or so that we were married. This perfect little family of the 50s with two girls and two boys, and it did blow up like smoke, you know, and my whole life changed. So Ted was a good listener. He was very good at reading other people, so he could get from them what he perceived they wanted from him. He could be all different kinds of personality, but he was good, and he was good on the phones. Although I found after I left, my shift ended at 2 a.m., and he would always insist upon walking me out to my car. He'd say, "Ann, be sure the door's locked because I don't want anything bad to happen to you." I still didn't suspect anything about Ted Bundy that was dangerous about Ted Bundy.
You've been listening to a slice of John Safran's True Crime. Catch the full show, 3 p.m. each Sunday on ABC Radio National, or hit the RN website for the podcast. It's all killer, no filler.
Father Bob, there's a new film coming out called Rush, about Formula One drivers in the 1970s.
Oh.
And it's causing a controversy because in the 1970s, all the cars had Marlboro painted on them and other cigarette brands, and Camel, and maybe Cool with a K. And as anti-smoking advocates are saying, listen, this is a bad message to the kid.
You've got to take them off.
Yeah, you shouldn't. And they're saying at the very least, the trailer that goes out, the kids should not have to see. But then it becomes, well, when does history become a thing? Like, you're whitewashing history.
I know.
I say, I'm going to take a stand on this.
What are you going to say?
I don't care.
You're an old advertiser, aren't you?
No, I'm going to say, I'm on the side of the artists, and I'm way more sympathetic to, we want to do a historically accurate film.
Of course.
And the historical accuracy was that Marlboro was painted on all the things, and I reckon go with that. I reckon it'll look weird without it.
Well,
like having to make up these brands. I don't know about that.
I mean, all your famous remakes of famous old films, surely to God, if you've got people smoking all over the place, what do you do?
Well, you know,
that's what
Steven Spielberg did with E.T. He took out the guns or something and put in
water pistols.
Radios. What do you call them? Like little
two-way radios or talking.
Yeah, and
then
their things. And I think he later recanted. Like at least he regretted going, that was a artistic mistake to kind of cave in to
this
that.
This is the way we were, eh? Much drinking, much. Yes, I know what you mean. Anyway, thanks for that.
What would you think of
Marlboro,
me?
Marlboro, eh? Oh, Marlboro.
I'm thinking of buying.
Lucky Strike? You never heard of Lucky Strike? Anyway, sorry.
Sunday Night Safran.
With John Safran and Father Bob Maguire on Triple J.
What would you think of me if I bought a ring that had like a pig's head, like a metal pig's head on it? Would that...
Well, you're saying you'd put that in my face and I'd say that was inappropriate and offensive.
I heard that the new thing is, because look at this bracelet. I've had this for a long time.
What's it got?
Believe it or not.
And a gun on it.
Have you not seen my gun bracelet
before?
Well,
in the old days when you were a bit rattier, you were wearing that.
Yeah, well, it's back on board, baby.
For the book.
Well, not for the book. It's just like, anyway, I started wearing this again and I started reading about bracelet. Why are you pulling that disgust?
Go on. I mean, because you're being provocative.
Why is this being? It's just like it's a bracelet and it's got a gun on it.
Yeah, the day after Aaron Alexis.
Ah, okay, I see.
Go on.
But I read a thing.
And you're going to put a pig's thing on your ring.
No,
now.
Do you know? Yeah, a pig's thing.
And you're going to go back to balaclava
with a pig. But it could be the other way, because it could be like I've killed the pig because.
Oh, no, you would. That's not. You know.
Anyway,
that.
But do you know what I read about men's like bracelets?
Yes.
Is that apparently the thing is it's for guys who really want tattoos, but are like thinking of their future, like going, well, because all you guys with tattoos, you can look at me without my tattoos, and just say I'm a wuss. And so why are you going around with a gun bracelet and a pig's head on your finger? Just get it tattooed. But you don't understand. I've got to in my job, I've got to do other things. I've got to be, you know, discreet.
Well, I can't have swallows. You're visual.
Yeah, I can't have swallows on my neck.
No, you can't have that.
Because, you know, I have to go walk in, like, to, like, a politician's office or whatever. Yeah. So, but apparently that's the thing. That's the psychology behind why guys buy bracelet and rings is because they really want
to. Thank you for that. You learn things every night. Every time I come, that's why I keep coming. You learn things like that. You say, I wouldn't have known that.
That was fairly thin gruel, though.
But how do I know it's true anyway? I mean, it's because you said it doesn't mean to say it's true.
Now, I want to talk about this. I actually want to get this guy on, this author on, so I don't know. What the hell? We might never get him on, so let's just burn it. Let's just burn the material.
Go on.
A gay author called Mr. Jimenez, and you know when I... Stephen Jimenez has written a book which he claims is telling the real Matthew Shepard story. You know about Matthew Shepard. He's the young gay kid who was killed in the 90s in Wyoming. He was killed because he was gay. And there's always been this sort of like slight thing of, well, was there some like little drug thing involved? So it was more like it was an argument over drug. Anyway, this whole thing. Anyway, this gay author has investigated and he's coming out. I'm not saying... Dear listener, I am not saying this is the truth. I'm saying this is what is being put out. He's saying that he's done the investigation and he feels that it wasn't a homophobic killing. Mm. And that, in fact, one of the kids who killed him was bisexual himself. And it was really, not that it wasn't homophobic, but it was like more complicated and messy or whatever.
Yes.
Right? But then, like, it's one of those things where there's so much invested in it, because obviously... In actuality, there is huge amounts of homophobia out there.
Mm-hmm.
But then as soon as you kind of localise it to this one story...
It evaporates.
Well, no, it becomes complicated because then it becomes like, well, hang on, if that's not... And it's just confusing. Having said that, it's very early days. The person has just released a book. There'll be lots of back and forth. And who knows, maybe this will disappear into smoke like the 9/11 conspiracies or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? But... Yeah, just goes. This is what I'm always warning you, dear listeners. If you've got a political cause, be really careful how you localize it, because then you sort of have to like live or die a bit about the facts in that particular case. You know, so you know the case I always bring up is what's his face, that guy who shot the police. God, why can't I remember?
No,
his
why
name?
Can't I remember? Why you can't remember?
Yeah. Mumia.
Where what, shot the police?
In America, and anyway, so there's this whole kind of cult of kind of built out. Like, let's tell the story of how white police officers oppress black people through this particular story, right? But then the problem when you localize it that much is like, maybe there is a big problem with racism against black people, but maybe in this particular case, the facts don't back up that story, and now you've invested so much in it, it just becomes awkward as the years roll on more information comes out.
Yeah, that's like your story about Sophie.
Sophie
in
who?
Indi.
Oh, in Indi?
Yeah, now you were muttering and banging on about how there might be something local there that the mainstream media don't go on about.
Yes.
And lo and behold, ladies and gentlemen, you would say that may well be the reason why she in fact lost Indi.
Even though
we'll know nothing about it. Anyway, let's continue. We've got to say we're going to go to a song and we're going to come back.
We are
after that break.
But do come back because we'll have more fights after this, dear listeners. You are listening to me, John Safran,
and me, Bob McGuire,
on Triple J FM and DAB Plus. That's the digital plus.
Is it?
Sunday Night Safran
with John Safran and Father Bob McGuire on Triple J.
That just about does it. But
do you know the people who are listening to this on digital haven't heard this sentence yet?
What is the sentence?
No, because apparently another thing is
delay.
Digital is apparently gets it's maybe 10 seconds behind FM. So basically, if you're listening to this on digital radio, everyone who's listening to this on FM has just heard me say this already, if that makes any sense.
Yeah?
Hmm.
Fascinating. What's the gap?
I think about 10 seconds.
It's a lot of time.
A lot can happen in 10. Oh, sorry, if you're listening on digital, something happened then that was, but you missed it.
Did you leak it?
No.
No.
Well, can you goddamn...
No, we're going to finish up now.
Yeah,
because
finish
we've
up.
Had a stimulating night. I want to talk about... I want to know who you thought did a real good job tonight. Your friend Anthony Lowenstein. It's yes. always a pleasure to listen to you two going at it.
Mm.
Who else? Luke Williams, who said that I ogled him when he was in the studio.
And that I...
let him get away with that. Go on. Yeah.
And then we spoke to Anne Rule.
Anne Rule, the author of The Stranger Beside Me, who featured in your true crime series.
Yes, thank you very much, you listeners. You can follow Bob on Twitter, or me on Twitter, yeah, or Soipul, the producer, on Twitter. Her name is spelled S to the O to the I to the P to the L.
And or you can follow it on Sunday Night Saffron Facebook page, or on head to SoundCloud, and you can download the podcast from www.triplej.net.au/saffron or from iTunes. Fenella.
Hey, Fenella. Now, tune in next week and you'll hear us again, or if you're on digital, tune in 10 seconds later.
Yeah.
And thank you very
much. Thank you, Jono. Thank you, Serple.
Peace be upon you.